and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of conversation with scholars, librarians, and others about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today, who is with us by telephone, is Beth Louie, founder of the scholarly publishing program at Arizona State University, which she directed for more than 25 years. She's also author of the Handbook for Academic Authors, first published by Cambridge University Press in 1987 and now in its fifth edition. She has been president of the Association for Documentary Editing, the International Association for Publishing Education, and the Society for the History of Authorship, Reading, and Publishing. She's also served on the board of the Society for Scholarly Publishing and has served as the editor of the book series of the American Association for State and Local History. She's also received numerous awards for teaching and for distinguished professional service. She's with us today to talk about her latest book, Expanding the American Mind, Books and the Popularization of Knowledge, published by the University of Massachusetts Press in 2010. Hello, Beth.
Hello.
It's great to have you on the show. Your book is a history of a type of book that attempts to bridge the great chasm of unknowing that exists between academic writers and ordinary readers. Books that bring the fruits of academic scholarship to the general public, in other words. And I wonder if it's fair to say that your own book is an example of the very type of work it investigates, you know, since it certainly manages to communicate a great deal of historical, theoretical, and sociological information about a specific area of publishing in a way that is accessible and that I think most readers would find interesting as a kind of general nonfiction read.
Well, I hope it is. That's what I was aiming for. I don't see any reason why the history of anything needs to be difficult to understand. And I honestly believe, as Margaret Mead did, that any scholar should be able to explain his or her work to a 12-year-old. And if you can't, you ought to go back and work at it a little harder.
Yeah. So as the author of the Handbook for Academic Authors, you've literally written the book about academic writing, and I wonder if the work you've done over the course of your career in teaching scholars to communicate clearly motivated you at all to write Expanding the American Mind.
Well, it contributed to it. Really, the book is something that I've thought about since I was a small child.
Mm-hmm.
I learned to read at a very young age, and reading has always been important to me. But I always wondered why people read and why people choose to read what they do. My parents were also readers, especially my father. And I remember that although there were books all over the house, there were only three in the living room. And one was an illustrated art book, and I figured out why that would be in the living room. One was a book called The Romance of Research. My father was a scientist, and that was a book that had inspired him when he was a younger man. And the third one was God's Graves and Scholars, the first popular archaeology book that was published in the United States. And I always wondered about that book and why my father had it. And
That was about the Troy discovery, wasn't it?
It was about lots of different archaeological explorations and the archaeologists who made the discoveries.
I wonder also, you know, if part of the draw of your book here, for me at least, I think this is the case, is that as a popularizing book about popularizing books and their audience, it's a book about me. You know, we had Andrew Piper on last week talking about how much a book serves as a kind of mirror. The recto of a page will reflect the verso of the page across from it. You know, the book in some way experientially seems to mirror the reader. And in this case, your book does seem to mirror the reader in that it's about readers of just this kind of work. So apart from situating me historically in the act I'm engaged in when I take the book up, there's also this kind of sense of infinite regression possible that I thought makes the book function more as a kind of Borgesian thing than just the usual survey.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote this book so late in my career was that I could never quite figure out how to get at the subject. Mm-hmm. I thought about writing a biography of someone who had done this, someone like Barbara Tuchman. I thought about just a variety of things. And then when the Society for the History of Authorship, Reading, and Publishing started, the name really gave me the idea of how to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't separate the history of the genre from the study of authorship from the study of reading and the study of publishing. It's a great big ball of wax that you have to look at in its entirety.
Now, it's a wonderful society. They have wonderful conferences every year, I know, and they've got a publication, the Sharp Bulletin, and Book History, I think, too, they publish. So.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Can you give us the names of some popularizing academic books or authors that our readers might recognize, just so we know the sort of book we're talking about here?
Well, certainly, if you look at the list of Pulitzer Prizes, that's always a good place to start. Annette Gordon Reed's book about the Hemings family mm-hmm. is just a beautiful example yeah. Of this kind of writing.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite popular science books is The Beak of the Finch,
mm-hmm.
Jonathan Weiner's book about evolutionary biology, which is just a marvel of craftsmanship, of putting huge amounts of information in a rather small book and
mm-hmm.
helping people understand how scientists work as well as what evolution is all about and what scientists themselves are like. Another history book that I think many people know is A Midwife's Tale. That's one of my
yeah.
favorites because my current career, since I retired from Arizona State, is working as a documentary editor at the Adams Papers. And her book is based on a single document that earlier scholars had thought was so mundane that it wasn't worth looking at. And she builds a whole world around that very small diary.
Yeah. Then you mentioned Carl Sagan, and there
mm-hmm.
were these sort of greats who came along and popularized what was going on in the science of the 60s and 70s. And, of course, there's John Kenneth Galbraith, right?
Yes.
He's
a wonderful example.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons he's a wonderful example is that his books read as though they just flowed from his pen. You know, he sat down one morning and wrote a book. But if you actually look at the correspondence with his editors and you look at his own memoirs, you discover that he worked very hard at his writing to make it
yeah.
look that simple and straightforward. And he, too, was on television.
Yeah, it's best to make use of all the media you can, I think.
Right.
Why is it that so much scholarly writing is so impenetrable?
Oh, I think there are some good reasons and some bad reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The good reasons are that much of what scholars do needs to be communicated only to other scholars. And you save a lot of trees by assuming that your readers know what you know,
yeah.
except for your latest discovery. And you don't have to provide context, and you can use shorthand and jargon that everyone will understand. So that's the good reason. When you try to communicate with other people, though, that doesn't work so well. And I think that the inability to move from one audience to another is a serious difficulty.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is also the need to be obscure, to look smarter than you really are.
Yeah. Yeah, I wondered about that. You know, if the lay public can't understand much academic work, it's just true that academics often find their own colleagues' work indecipherable, you know, and that the Ivory Tower has a lot in common with the Tower of Babel, with everybody sort of speaking the same language,
right,
you know. And,
it does.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there are things that could be done about that. I've often thought that when someone comes up for tenure or promotion, part of the instructions should be, well, you know, there are people on your committee who aren't physicists or who aren't, you know, whatever the person is. So devote one or two pages of your portfolio to explaining the importance of your work and what it means to people who aren't in your field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that would be an interesting challenge for most people.
It would. You know, I just actually, in fact, last week had a friend tell me about being unable to provide any kind of useful input on a college-wide peer review committee for, you know, material submitted in a scientific discipline. You know, she's a humanist. And, of course, no medievalists will tell you that there are two people in the world who are qualified to pass judgment on their work or even able to understand it. And one of them, you know, is their own self. So, you know, and the other one's probably the dissertation advisor.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I remember I used to be a university press editor,
mm-hmm.
and I remember the director of the press bringing in a new manuscript that was part of the series that we were committed to publish, kind of rolling his eyes and saying that the cover letter said that there are only 5 people in the world who can understand this book.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what a publisher wants to hear.
No, but if it was back in the days when, 500 libraries would buy the book, it's not so bad, I suppose, but that isn't the case anymore. So.
No, well, this would have been in the 70s, and in those days, 1,000 to 1,500 libraries would buy any scholarly book. Now it's about 300.
Yeah. Yeah, so, sort of follow-up question there is, I often hear that academic publishers who can't depend on their parent institutions or on academic libraries anymore to buy a sufficient number of books to sustain their costs are always looking for what they call crossover books, books which can serve their authors in the peer review process and at the same time appeal to readers outside of their disciplines and outside of the academy altogether. And, I wonder then, is the crisis in academic monograph publishing a good reason to reexamine the notion of specialization then in academic writing?
Well, it is, but I think there's more to it than that. University presses nowadays do hire developmental editors. When they get a book that looks like it could have a broader audience, if more work were put into it, and if the author is willing to do it, they'll work with the author to make the book more accessible and interesting to a larger group. But the other question is whether publishing is driven by the needs of readers or by the needs of authors. And the Modern Language Association, for example, has questioned whether a monograph really is an appropriate tenure requirement in literary studies. Why do we require that? A lot of books in the field really are padded out essays, padded out articles. Why not give people credit for the articles and be done with it? So I think there's a lot that needs to be thought about in terms of audience and the purpose of publication. I don't think we can reform the academy very quickly, and I don't think that publishers are going to be able to do it, but I think it would be a good idea for administrators to think about why they want their authors to publish, what their goals are, and what the most appropriate media are.
Yeah, sure. Getting institutions to change their peer review requirements.
Well, I don't have a problem with peer review. I think it's essential. But I do have a problem with requiring vast numbers of articles. There's so many journals that nobody reads. So many journal articles that are never cited. Clearly, they're not advancing knowledge. They're advancing careers.
Yeah.
And that's not the same thing.
Your book contains a great deal of work on the history of publishing and the history of reading and writing. And is it fair to say that the great schism between scholarly and popular writing is a fairly recent phenomenon?
Yeah, it begins with the rise of the research university in the late 19th century, but it becomes much more extreme after World War II when the government, at least in the United States, when the government starts investing in research and pouring huge sums of money into universities so that doing research becomes not only a scholarly goal but a financial goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you really see the growth of specialization, the focus on research over teaching, and the other things that drive the vast amount of print that pours out of the ivory tower.
Yeah. And then this is sort of ramped up in the 20th century, isn't it? Especially with the Cold War. And
yes. In many ways, the Manhattan Project was the beginning. It was the first time that the federal government saw that it could spend money, bring scholars together, and accomplish a focused purpose. And it worked. And then right after the war, you get national laboratories, you get NASA, you get the NSF, especially the growth in science during the Cold War. And then in the 60s, the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities show up with much less money, but still encouraging research outside the sciences.
And we're not saying research is a bad thing, are we?
It's just if people are doing research simply because I have to have 5 more articles or I'm not going to get tenure, and I don't really care where I publish them or what they say or whether anyone reads them, that's not good.
One of the things your discussion of the history of popularized scholarship brings out is the importance of the development of a readership among the general public for this kind of book, that the two are closely bound together, and that this historically recent genre of writing has been to a great extent driven by readerly demand. Is that a fair statement?
You have a larger public that understands the impact that the Academy has on our lives, that we need to understand new knowledge to be good citizens, to be informed, to make decisions about our own lives and even about who we're going to vote for and why. Mm-hmm. So it's just that a larger audience comes from greater education, and that in turn generates the need for people to publish books that their former students can read and understand, and to promote their ideas and their fields to that larger public.
Yeah, you have to take literacy into consideration in all these discussions, I guess. So.
Yeah, you know, one of the things when I was looking at literacy, the history of literacy and the history of education, you do not get universal mandatory high school education in the United States until 1960.
1960?
1960.
Good heavens.
You know, across the board, every state.
Yeah.
Which I just stunned me.
Yeah.
You know, I had to look at that several times to believe it. So it's fairly recent that you have large numbers of people who are equipped to read difficult books.
Yeah. You also make the case, an interesting case, you mentioned this a couple of times, that in the West, at least, the general public, whenever the opportunity has arisen over the centuries, has demonstrated a real hunger for ideas, essentially, you know, to know what there is to know. That when they're given an opportunity to learn to read and then to read, they take right to it.
I think that's true, and that's why I'm so much in favor of broader education and giving people the opportunity to learn as much as they can in whatever way they can. I think it's crucial for our survival as a nation. I was just thinking the other day, there was a discussion of the use of drones. Well, we all need to understand what that means, and that requires understanding the technology, the political effect, legal questions it raises, so you have to understand how the law works and how it's formulated. And it certainly raises ethical questions, so we need to know how to think about ethical questions, not just say, oh, that doesn't sound right to me, or sounds good. How do you grapple with that? So all of those, the training that you get in college to question, to think critically, is what's so important and what this sort of book contributes to.
You know, one of the things we tell people about undergraduate education is that it should prepare people for lifelong learning. And although a bachelor's degree does provide instruction across a range of disciplines in the arts and sciences, I would guess that few college graduates who don't go on into graduate programs are able to read much in the way of the raw academic literature that's published in any but one or two fields at the most. You know, and I think the graph falls off pretty quickly from the point of graduation. You know, I'm reminded of Father Guido Sarducci and his five-minute university, you know, where, you know, he can teach you in 5 minutes everything you're going to remember 5 years out of college, you know. So it seems to me that this kind of book is essential, and it's an essential building block in this program of lifelong education.
I think it's very important, but it's a much more difficult task for the writer than just writing for one's peers. There might even be some sort of mathematical relationship where the harder it is to write the book, the easier it is to understand. So that might be worth investigating at some point.
Although this kind of popularizing scholarship is difficult to write, it might be difficult to write for some scholars who just, you know, weren't used to writing for a large audience, it still occurs to me that it would be a very worthwhile thing for many scholars to do. We had a marvelous discussion 2 weeks ago with Adina Hoffman and Peter Cole on Solomon Schechter and the importance for a great scholar of being able to see both the forest and the trees at the same time, is the way they put it, that scholarship requires minute attention to detail, but it also should involve the ability to imagine or realize the way the thing in focus relates to the whole of knowledge. And in Schechter's case, this was in fact because he taught, and also he authored a whole series of popularizing works on Jewish civilization, you know, designed for a general audience. So one question that comes to mind here is that shouldn't we in fact regard the popularizing work that some scholars undertake as not a dumbed down version of what they do, but on an intellectual par or even, greater than ordinary scholarly writing, and that it is more intellectually challenging, or at least as intellectually challenging. It's just a different way of putting across ideas, and it's a way of relating ideas to the larger whole or coming to consider the significance of a discovery rather than just, you know, the fact that if A and B equals C, that's all we need to know. We don't have to know why, what it might imply.
Well, one of the things that I discovered in working on this book was that the people who write successfully, the scholars who write successfully for a general public, are almost always at the top of their field. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that. One reason is that publishers prefer to have big names on their books. But the other reason is that in order to write a book like this, you really have to have a grasp of your entire subject, of the most recent developments. You have to have your own point of view. You have to be able to get your own point of view across. You have to convince your readers that you know what you're talking about, or they're not going to buy the book, or they're not going to finish reading it. And you can't fake it. You really have to know what you're doing. And I think it's much more difficult than writing a very narrow book where there probably isn't anyone who can question what you've discovered because no one else has been in the archives or been in the lab with you. You can get that across very quickly and easily, but to have a grasp of the entire field and present a coherent view of it is quite a challenging problem.
Mm-hmm. You know, I interviewed a Vassar professor a couple of weeks ago, John Long, about his own very popularizing book describing his research with evolution and robots. And he cited as his motive that he saw it as an extension of his role as teacher, but he only came to see this after it was pointed out to him that he could reach a much wider audience than he had first imagined he'd be reaching. But even that, you know, wasn't enough of a motive for him, given the time, the investment in time, which, after all, faculty are pressed for time. Given the amount of time it was going to take, he just didn't have the time to put into it. He was finally convinced, especially when it was mentioned to him that he could get an advance on the project. He had never heard of that and the kind of work he had usually done. So anyway, are there other reasons why scientists and scholars should want to undertake to invest the time to do this kind of writing for a wider audience?
Well, I think so, especially in the sciences. Almost all scientific research is funded by taxpayer money. Mm-hmm. I think there's an obligation to justify the use of public money and to generate public support for science. I like to think about Carl Sagan, who probably did more for NASA's budget than anybody else in the country. It was the public support, public interest that was generated by his books and his TV programs mm-hmm. that NASA should be eternally grateful for. But it's also important to rescue people from popular idiocies. There's a great deal of nonsense out in the world uh-huh. about almost anything you can think of. And it's the scholars who know what's nonsense and what isn't mm-hmm. Who really have an obligation, instead of just sitting in their offices and fuming, to make people understand what the different arguments are and help them to decide which makes sense and which doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's the more important motivation. You never make a ton of money from any book.
No, he realized that very quickly when the royalties started to dribble in. So there was a story in The Guardian last week about secret funding channels that are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into climate change denial think tanks, which presumably produce propaganda of one kind or another in the guise of science for popular consumption, probably mostly on the web, but possibly there are monographs coming out of this also, or even who knows, scientific articles and scientific journals. And this is apart from the propaganda spread by the petrochemical industries or the Koch brothers. And it's quite plain from people who write in this area that commercial influences in scientific research seem to have an impact on the quality and accuracy of a lot of research outcomes. So my question is there a literature of bad science out there, especially in monograph form? I'm thinking, I mean, and no, the web is often suspect, that the popularization of bona fide research has to contend with.
Yeah, there is, and that's why I think peer review is a good thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of what comes out of think tanks is not peer reviewed. It's essentially vanity press publishing. It's been read only by people who were guaranteed to agree with it. So there are two ways to counter that. One is to make sure that there's lots of good science out there that's readable. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is to make sure that people have the ability to distinguish one thing from the other. That's one of the reasons why popular science books, I think, focus not just on telling people, here's what I found, mm-hmm. but here's how I found it, and here's how I know that my interpretation is right. Mm-hmm. Not just take my word for it, but let me show you how to figure this out yourself yeah. and understand it.
You devote a lot of page space in your book describing various kinds of efforts to bring the fruits of higher education to the masses, especially since the beginning of the 20th century. You mentioned Charles Eliot's Harvard Classics and the Great Books Program at the University of Chicago and publishers' efforts such as the Modern Library. In the 19th century, there was the public library movement, as well as the development of the idea of the correspondence course, which struck me as an interesting thing early on in England. And some of us, myself included, remember National Education Television, which ran afoul of the foundations that supported it back in the late 60s and early 70s when it strayed into controversial programming, and which was finally preempted by what seemed to me a sort of watered-down successor, the public broadcasting system. This was an experimental television network that transmitted very high-level programming, college-level lecturing and hard-hitting interviews, the sort of thing that you'd expect to find actually on today's MOOCs, which is the question I want to get to, but alas, they're long gone. However, you know, in Europe, the Open University is still going strong. And then now, just recently, we've seen the birth of the MOOC, the massively open online course that's being touted by some as a way for people to get the equivalent of a university education at home, but also as a technology that may make brick-and-mortar institutions obsolete. And I wonder if you see a continuity between MOOCs and these earlier efforts toward public education that you write about, or if MOOCs represent something new?
I think they are a continuation, but they do add a new dimension. I think they also have some of the problems that the five-foot shelf and the Great Books Program had. For MOOCs, I think it's important to distinguish between something like MIT putting its classes online free mm-hmm. so that anyone can learn the content, and a state university offering degrees online to get more mileage and more revenue out of the faculty. Mm-hmm. I think if you're presenting well-thought-out courses that require students to interact with one another and with the instructor, that's a boon to non-traditional learners. But just throwing up a bunch of lectures with a multiple-choice test at the end isn't higher education or really education at all. Mm-hmm. You had the same thing when Eliot put out the five-foot shelf of Harvard Classics. He certainly would not have claimed that someone who read all of them had gained the same thing that a student who could spend 4 years at Harvard had. Actually, the student who had read the five-foot shelf had read more mm-hmm. than anyone at Harvard ever does, and I say that as an alumna. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there were so many other things you didn't have, which is the opportunity to exchange ideas with other people, to express your opinions, have them shot down, have mm-hmm. them elaborated, to really engage in intellectual activity outside your own brain and that of a single author. So I think the MOOCs are an interesting phenomenon, and I think they have the potential to do a lot of good, but I don't think that all of those campuses are going to disappear
no,
very
no,
soon.
They're going to put us out of work. No,
no, I don't think so.
Though I wonder about, you know, the notion of the charismatic lecturer who can express difficult ideas to a large mm-hmm. audience. And actually, this is something that people who do teach in college learn to do if they're teaching undergraduates.
Right.
And that's why, frankly, that's the only reason I think my radio show, I can keep it afloat, that I'm talking to people who can make, you know, rather arcane research comprehensible to a general audience. So I do get excited about the thought that having a technology that distributes this kind of material to a wider audience might mean that we get not flashier teachers, but teachers who do think more about the larger picture.
That may be true. And I think there are charismatic lecturers out there who it's a shame to have only in a single classroom.
Mm-hmm.
You really would like them to get out to a larger audience. But when I think back to college, it's not so much the charismatic lecturers that I remember. Certainly, I don't always remember what they lectured about. But I remember the, you know, the smaller seminars
mm-hmm.
when the professor would... You know, you'd read something that you'd written or explain what you'd done, and the professor would ask you one question that got you right back to where you started and thinking in an entirely new way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of education that can't be taught just with books or just online. And I think it's so important to develop those critical thinking skills instead of just learning a bunch of stuff. It's the difference between information and understanding.
As a teacher of academic writing, what kind of advice do you have for someone in the academy doing research who might want to expand their readerships? What questions do you think they need to ask themselves?
Well, they have to think about who their readers are. What do those readers know? What do they want to know? I do workshops for faculty, and one of the exercises I often have people do is to pretend that they're sitting in the living room before Thanksgiving dinner, which is going to be served in about 5 minutes.
And mm-hmm.
They're sitting next to Aunt Ethel or Uncle George, who has very kindly sent them checks throughout graduate school and cookies and generally been very nice to them. And Aunt Ethel or Uncle George is a teacher, well-educated, intelligent. And with 5 minutes to dinner, Aunt Ethel says, "Now, dear, what are you working on?" And you have 5 minutes to explain it. And it's amazingly hard sometimes. You're so used to doing the hour-long version or the 10-minute version for
yeah.
your peers. But to be able to explain what you're doing and why it matters to someone who doesn't know what you know is a pretty daunting exercise at times. And also, because it's such an investment of your time, why are you doing this?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you want people to understand? Why is it important?
Though you do get the question. I mean, people that are just out of graduate school will be asked, you know, 100 times in the first year, what was your dissertation about?
Right.
You know, and
and the reason I do that is I do ask people in workshops that, and I mm-hmm. sometimes get, they'll give the answer in front of 15 or 20 of their fellow junior faculty members, and you get this glazed look on everybody's eyes, including my own. And that's when you have to call in Aunt Ethel.
Yeah.
You know, tell me what you just said in English.
Yes, okay.
And almost everyone can do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they've not had to. They've not been encouraged to do that.
As our program here is about research in libraries, can you tell us how you went about doing your research for the book?
Oh, yes. I did a lot of different things. You know, I did all the traditional things, going to publishers' archives to see how these books came into being, what the contributions of the publisher were, how they were marketed. I, of course, read many of the examples that I talk about, plus many other books. I did a survey of readers, which was a challenge, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you actually interviewed people, or?
I did some interviews, but I started with a survey, which booksellers and librarians helped me distribute, and asked people what else they read, among other things. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the false distinction among brows, the highbrow, lowbrow, and middlebrow,
yeah.
which I think is, I think it's faded away almost by now. Mm-hmm. But the idea that, you know, there are people who read only serious nonfiction and very important novels is total nonsense. People read everything. Yeah. They listen to different kinds of music. They read different kinds of books. They watch, you know, reality. Well, I don't watch reality TV, but I do watch Comedy Central. I listen to NPR, but I also watch Comedy Central South Park. We all take in different kinds of books and other media for different reasons.
Yeah, sure. There is this notion that used to be an old marketing adage about selling to the lowest common denominator, you know, but it always struck me there's nobody out there that actually fits that description.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful story Morton Feldman, the American composer, used to tell about a visit to his mentor and teacher, the composer Stefan Volpe. Morton Feldman was visiting Volpe in his Greenwich Village apartment. Feldman was receiving a scolding from Volpe, who thought Feldman's music too esoteric for the masses. And, you know, as Feldman used to tell the story, Volpe was shouting at him about the man in the street. And at that moment, Feldman said he was looking out of the window, filled with anxiety about this criticism. Feldman's music is very esoteric. And whom should he see loping across 14th Street below but Jackson Pollock? And according to Feldman, this was a revelation, you know. As he put it, from that moment on, the man on the street for him was Jackson Pollock. And he said, you know, ever after that, you know, that solved the problem for him of the man on the street. He knew that whoever he was writing for, the man on the street was always someone like Jackson Pollock. So that was a nice story.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things that I learned in my survey, I asked people how they felt about footnotes, because trade publishers have this idea that footnotes scare people off. Mm-hmm. That if you put footnotes in books, they'll look too scholarly and people won't read them. And I never really believed that, so I thought I'd ask readers. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who answered the questionnaire was a pipe fitter. And he'd gone to college. He hadn't graduated. And he just said, no, I want the notes at the bottom of the page. I'm going to read them anyway. Why not make it convenient for me?
Yeah.
Nobody is going to read the kinds of books I'm talking about if they haven't either been to college or in some way gotten themselves educated, even on their own, mm-hmm. beyond high school level. They have read books with footnotes. They know what they're for.
Yeah.
What's the big deal? You put them in.
Yeah.
The same thing with equations. You know, that Stephen Hawking's famous quote when he was writing A Brief History of Time. He said his publisher told him that every equation you put in the book cuts the number of readers in half. So he had planned not to put any equations in, but he decided he couldn't part with E equals MC squared, and he hoped that he hadn't cut his readership in half by doing that.
So I'd like to thank you, Beth, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Expanding the American Mind, Books and the Popularization of Knowledge, published by the University of Massachusetts Press.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much. You are listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie. We'll be back after this public service announcement.
Are you or a family member suffering from a disease? Are you just looking for the latest medical information? Then check out Medline Plus. With information from the National Institutes of Health, the federal government's premier agency supporting medical research, Medline Plus is your one-stop source for the latest medical information. Information about prescription drugs, clinical trials, and all sorts of information pertaining to your health. There's even a medical encyclopedia. It's all right there on your computer, www.medlineplus.gov. And if you crave the latest news from the cutting edge of medical science, PubMed Central and the NIH's new public access program can lead you there. The NIH Public Access Archive program is adding to the nearly 500,000 research articles already available online in PubMed Central. Log on to the NIH homepage, www.nih.gov, and click the link for public access. That's Medline Plus for up-to-date medical info, and Public Access and PubMed Central for the latest medical research results. These services brought to you by the National Institutes of Health.